This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you think about prison work programs, you think license plates and chain gangs, or that scene from Shawshank Redemption when the prisoners retar a roof. But today's convicts aren't just stamping out vanity plates or breaking up rocks by the side of the highway. They're making stuffed animals, breaking wild stallions, and growing artisanal food products. Graham Wood is books editor at Pacific Standard, where we found his article, From Our Prison to Your Table. Graham Wood, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Good to be here.
Well, Graham, I have to quote a line from your article that I just couldn't get over. You say, if you had eaten buffalo mozzarella in this country, there's a very good chance you've eaten the product of inmate labor. Really?
Yes. So the largest buffalo mozzarella or buffalo milk dairy in the country is in Canyon City, Colorado, and it's run pretty much entirely by inmates. It's artisanal. There's not that many buffalo milk producers in the country, but this is the biggest one. So if you've eaten buffalo milk mozzarella, if you eat it regularly, then almost certainly you've had their product.
And that is the site of Colorado Correctional Industries, which you toured. Tell us a little bit about your visit.
It's an enormous campus in a really beautiful setting in the Colorado mountains. If you saw it from the road, you might not think it's a prison. It doesn't really look like one. It's just a big open space. But it's got 4,000 inmates who are there, and most of them are working in these industries. And many of them are outdoor agricultural industries, like raising buffaloes. But there are some who have other agricultural things, like making wine grapes, breaking stallions, as you say. And others who work on stitching stuffed animals and other things. So it's a great big multi-dimensional prison work colony.
It's unbelievable, some of the products. They raise Hungarian partridges. They raise red-clawed Australian lobsters, tilapia, blackberries. Why these niche products?
First of all, you're making me hungry just remembering these things. You know, the reason they choose these niche products, I think, is because they could raise more conventional items. And, you know, they do have cows and some other things. If they have niche products, though, then they're less likely to be stepping on the feet of private industry. You know, there aren't very many entities in the United States that are raising Hungarian partridges, but there's a demand for Hungarian partridges. It's small. Hunting clubs want them so they can be released and then shot. But, you know, if prisoners are doing it, they're unlikely to be destroying other industries elsewhere, and there's also less likelihood that those industries will lead a push for more scrutiny of the practices of the prison labor.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of fly under the radar this way by having niche industries instead of mainstream ones.
How much are CCI inmates paid, and how might that compare with other prison workers in other prisons?
They're paid reasonably well by prison worker standards. After all, there are some state systems where prisoners don't get paid anything. CCI inmates, though, we're talking about $1.50 an hour,
mm-hmm.
So well below federal minimum wage. Again, first of all, they're prisoners, so they don't have much choice. And second of all, a lot of their money is taken away. Even if they were paid more, most of it would be taken away for things like restitution and other kinds of fees that inmates are subject to, but the free people are not.
They will break a stallion for you at CCI for $900. So the prisoners don't make money based on tasks, do they?
No, they don't. They are paid by the hour they work. There's also the disincentives that are offered to them. If they don't do a good job or if they're not diligent in their labor, then they can be sent right back into the general population.
Mm-hmm. So this is a plum job. They want to be out of the general population.
Yes. The prisoners who I saw were people who had really earned their way into the CCI labor system. You know, if you screw up in a regular job, you might get fired, you might get disciplined. If you screw up in these jobs, you get sent back into what, you know, like most prison systems in the United States, a very unpleasant place. But instead, they're out there in the open air. They have something to do with their time. And I think it's really psychologically good for them to be out there, even if we have questions about whether the labor practices are ones we'd like to encourage.
Right. Some critics say that prison work programs like CCI and some in Texas are enormous corporations operating with slave labor. What's the answer to that?
In a way, that's accurate. Of course, slaves weren't paid anything, but these people, they don't have the same rights as normal workers. And so if you're concerned about making sure that workers are able to unionize, to air collective grievances, then basically you're talking about a whole industry, an enormous corporation whose labor is literally captive. And of course, there's worries about that. As one person I spoke to said, you couldn't expect prisoners to meaningfully consent to medical experimentation or testing. Why would you expect them to be able to meaningfully consent to a labor contract? And you know that causes a lot of concern for people who are concerned about labor.
We're speaking with Graham Wood. He's books editor at Pacific Standard, and he visited the Colorado Correctional Industries. That's a place where artisanal products like tilapia and partridges and Chardonnay grapes are farmed by prisoners working for about $1.50 an hour. Well, obviously, this is presented as a benefit to prison bottom lines, right? How much are prisons or states making off of these kind of operations?
They're making tens of millions of dollars per year. They can't take state funds if they fail. And so the Colorado Correctional Industries in particular, they have to make sure that they make enough money to at least be a profitable entity. They really don't do a whole lot more than that, but they do need to make sure that they're not taking state funds and being a drain on resources. It's a lot easier to do that, of course, if you're not paying people more than $1.50 an hour.
But it is still a big gamble for them. How about the companies that would partner with CCI? Not everybody is going to want to buy something that they know was made in prison. How do they sell it to customers?
Well, that's an interesting trick. So there are rules that say that when products of prison labor come out of prisons, they have to be labeled as products of prison labor. But of course, if you have eaten buffalo milk mozzarella, there's no label on the milk that says that. Or in the cheese that says that. What they can do, however, is when it comes out the prison doors, it has to say it's made by prison labor. When it finally gets to the customer, though, it's been repackaged, and legally so that you can't tell. And so the stigma that might be there for some kinds of prison labor products has been erased by the time it gets to the end consumer.
Where are these products being sold?
They're being sold to people like you. At Whole Foods, for example, they carry tilapia that's raised in Canyon City, Colorado's farm. They could be in any consumer grocery store. You could find a product of prison labor.
Well, I guess you think especially of the shopper at Whole Foods, you know, somebody who's very aware of artisanal foods and priding themselves on buying fair trade products. What if people did know that these products were being made by inmates?
I think you'd find that a lot of shoppers would be uncomfortable about this. And, you know, Whole Foods doesn't really make an effort to conceal the fact that they're raised by inmates, but of course they don't stress that either. You know, there are things like Australian red clawed lobsters that are largely purchased by these kinds of coastal elites that are very sensitive to labor issues or like to think of themselves as sensitive. And so if you find a large consumer movement that tries to object to prison labor, there might be some traction there. But so far that hasn't happened.
These kind of prison work programs are also positioned as helping inmates, you know, teaching them skills, trades. Is that a fair claim?
I think so. You know, whatever concerns we have about the programs, one of the complications is that they almost certainly are good for the prisoners. That is, if you put someone in a cage for 6 years, then how much use is that person going to be in the labor force when he gets out, especially if his previous experience before prison was as a hold-up artist or a criminal? These people are working jobs that keep their minds active, teach them some skills, and that eventually perhaps teach them how to hold a job for the first time in their lives. And, of course, you have to remember that the prisoners who graduate to the privilege of working in these industries, they've already proven themselves to be some of the least incorrigible inmates. But, yeah, when you actually see them working diligently as you know, serious members of a labor force, and also working side by side with free workers who are there as usually as managers for the joint venture partners of business that work in the prisons, then you can see that they certainly rehabilitated themselves if they were as bad as you might guess.
Graham Wood, thank you so much. It's just an amazing story, and appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Graham Wood is books editor at Pacific Standard. You'll find a link to read his article from our prison to your dinner table and see some of the photographs from CCI. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. The word doula comes from ancient Greek and translates to female servant or woman who serves. Over the years, however, it has come to mean birth companion and now refers to a woman who provides emotional and physical support to other women before, during, and after labor. While doulas are often employed in hospital and home births, one group is trying to make those services available in prisons as well. Shauna Ray brings us this story of a project at the Washington Correctional Center for Women in Olympia, Washington.
Go inside yourself for a moment and imagine the intensity of labor and childbirth. Imagine you're about to embark on an exercise of physical will, that in the near future, you will encounter a massive hurdle, one that must be confronted to get to the other side. Now imagine that you are approaching this challenge without family and without loved ones. Instead, you'll have a guard standing watch, possibly with shackles around your ankles, wrists, your arms restrained, enveloped in each contraction without the ability to move. Now, compound all of this with the anxiety of not knowing if you'll get to keep your child. The first 24 hours may be all the time you have to hold it. For a majority of women who find themselves giving birth while serving their sentence in a correctional facility in the United States, this experience has traditionally been their fate. And it is this tradition of laboring in isolation that the Birth Attendants Prison Doula Project is working to change by bringing their doula services inside the Washington Correctional Center for Women. What exactly are the services of a doula, you may be asking?
The role of a doula is to advocate for a woman during labor and birth, or answer any questions that she might have about her pregnancy and her labor, and a doula also provides postpartum care.
That was the voice of Huki, program coordinator with the Birth Attendants Prison Doula Project. Though the word doula is Greek in origin, the concept is multicultural, present wherever there are women and mothers supporting each other through pregnancy, labor, and birth. And in the case of doulas who bring their services to incarcerated women, Huki says their presence fills a crucial gap.
Working with incarcerated women, it's a little different in that, generally speaking, prisoners aren't provided with a lot of information. And so we bring in pregnancy books, we bring in postpartum books, child development books, and then we also provide a space for women to look to the wisdom that's already there in the prison, because there's a lot of women that come to our support groups who have children, have had multiple children, and so they can answer a lot of those questions for each other. Really a big part of it, too, is just to provide a space to witness women in their experience of being incarcerated and being pregnant.
According to the Women's Prison Association, the large majority of women in U.S. prisons and jails are first-time offenders serving time for nonviolent offenses. Property and drug-related arrests make up two-thirds of incarcerated females. These women are often survivors of physical and sexual abuse. Compound that with a lack of mental health care, the war on drugs, and mandatory minimum sentences, and you begin to humanize those women living behind bars.
As a society, we forget about people who are incarcerated. We don't want to think about them, or we put these labels on them as criminals. Really, they're just women.
And beyond the debate over whether detention is the best way to handle those crimes, it still remains that in order to have the healthiest outcome, an expecting woman requires certain fundamental things. According to the Young Mothers United Incarcerated Young Mothers Bill of Rights, proper prenatal care, medical examinations, and screenings are amongst them. Underlying all these things is information, and that's the core of what doulas provide. Genesis had her baby at the Washington Center for Women.
The first time I went to doulas, it was because it was a labor class, and I didn't know nothing about labor. I never had a kid before, nothing. You're more scared and nervous about going into labor than you are about being here.
Concerns about labor and delivery can be especially complicated, according to Marin, a direct service doula with the collective.
When you're pregnant, you need your community, and you need people around you who you feel safe with, and you need great medical care. You need to be able to decide what kind of doctor or midwife or care provider you want there with you, and you need to be able to decide if there's someone who specifically you don't want to be around you while you're giving birth, or you don't want them to be around you while you're having medical screenings, and you pretty much don't get any of that when you're incarcerated.
Since 2002, when the program was established, over 100 women in Washington State have been able to avoid being in labor by themselves. Again, here's Huki.
During her labor, typically we're the only one that's with her, except for the medical staff that's coming in and out. And then there's an officer that now sits outside the door. Before we started doing this work, it would be an officer inside the room with a curtain pulled, and that was usually it. Occasionally, a woman gets a special visitor approved, so she might have her mother with her. Maybe a sister might be with her. She may have her partner with her. I think I've been to one birth where a woman had her partner with her. And also, the officer has to call that special visitor to let them know that the woman is in labor, and sometimes that doesn't happen either.
To attest to one such misfortune, we go again to Genesis.
It was not easy. I had approval for my parents to come, but then they lost the paperwork, so I had to do it by myself. It was hard. I was handcuffed to a bed until I was in delivery because of my custody level.
Simon Conrad, the longest-standing doula with the organization, says that isolation can have some serious consequences for the mother.
When any person, whether they're incarcerated or not, is in labor and they don't have an advocate there for them, things can very quickly change. When you have a doctor telling you that, you know, you have to have an epidural or you have to have a cesarean, you know, not progressing quickly enough, people get nervous. You know, it's a doctor. You've kind of always been told that if a doctor's telling you something, that's what needs to happen. So we find that when people don't have an advocate sometimes, they're more prone to get off the path that they wanted for their birth experience.
In addition to supporting these women through pregnancy, labor, and delivery, the birth attendants facilitate reproductive health classes and support groups. One major focus is postpartum depression, which is even more common amongst incarcerated women since they usually have their babies taken away soon after birth. Teresa Correll had her baby at the Washington Center for Women.
I mean, the whole time I was pregnant here, I was scared because I was hoping that I got to keep my baby with me. I mean, that was just the whole time I was pregnant. I was trying to keep him inside me. Pretty much had to leave him at the hospital and come here. And that just, I never thought I'd have to do that.
It's been really hard. That's what it's been. It's really been hard.
I never thought I'd have a baby and then not be home with it. You know, I'm scared. I'm not bonding with him. I feel like a yo-yo half of the time. I don't know. They pretty much tell me I can't be a mother. I mean, my baby's going to be a year and a half old when I get home. It's bad to say, but it doesn't even feel like. I have a new baby. I mean, it just doesn't because he got taken from me.
Teresa's baby went to one of her relatives, who Child Protective Services deemed fit to raise the child. But in the event that there is no next of kin, doula Simon Conrad says a mother can lose the rights to her baby forever.
If there isn't family that can take the baby, the child goes into foster care. Now, one of the things that can happen with that is that if you don't see your child for 15 months or more, technically that child can become ward of the state. And that means the parent will never be the legal guardian of that child again. You know, if the child is being fostered 6 hours away and the family can't afford to bring the baby to the prison for visitation, the parent can technically lose guardianship of that child for no fault of their own.
There are a few prisons in the U.S. with alternative nurseries where mothers get to spend the first bonding years with their babies. At the Washington State Prison, where the birth attendants operate, for example, there is a residential parenting program. But despite its proven positive influence on recidivism rates, the program can only accommodate 20 mothers at once. Simon says the lack of public support for incarcerated mothers stems from an oversimplification of who those women are.
People always want to know what happens to the baby. And I would say, well, it's A, B, or C. And then I say, but, you know, there's the woman, and she's having her experience. And children are very important, of course, but these women are important too, and their experience is valid and needs to be witnessed and should be supported. It's a beautiful thing.
There are a sprinkling of other facilities around the country with similar birth attendant programs, but they are few and far between. So for now, the mothers gather, share their experiences with each other, and try to get through their time.
And that story was produced by Shauna Ray for the show Making Contact. What if there were a relatively easy way to provide human waste disposal and provide safe drinking water to communities that don't have access to either? Well, there is. Coming up, waste to drinking water and other solutions that are just too gross to catch on. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 750 million people around the world do not have access to safe drinking water, and at least 2 billion lack access to proper sanitation. A project funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation proposes a solution for both. The Omni Processor, a low-cost waste treatment plant, can turn up to 14 tons of sewage into drinkable water each day. Although a completely sanitary technology, waste-to-water treatment faces an overwhelming oppositional force: disgust. The foundation acknowledged as much by releasing a video of Bill Gates himself drinking a glass of Omni-processed water. When it comes to environmental and social concerns, disgust may play a much larger role in shaping policy than we think. Maria Konnikova writes about psychology and science for The New Yorker, both of which came together in a recent article called Problems Too Disgusting to Solve. And Maria, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the technology for turning human waste into drinking water, that's been around for some time. Is revulsion the only thing holding it back from being adopted?
To be perfectly honest, I think that it's, if not the only thing, then certainly the single most important thing. Because as you say, we've had this technology for years and years, and we've had people trying to sell it internationally. We're not just talking about the United States. There are lots of areas where there are water shortages. Singapore, California could definitely use something like this. But people just refuse to drink it because they hear recycled water. They think toilet to tap. They think, oh my God, this cannot possibly be safe. I don't care what you tell me. My instinct is to say, this is disgusting.
Well, and the disgust is so automatic, it's so instinctive and irrational. Is there an evolutionary reason we developed it?
Absolutely. And the reason is actually very solid. A lot of the things that evoke disgust in us should evoke disgust in the sense that they can hurt us. So, you know, sometimes you'll be in an area, you'll be walking, and suddenly it's very slimy, and you say, ooh, this feels gross. I want to get out of here. Well, chances are there are actually lots of bacteria that are living there, so that's a very natural thing to say. You should get out. When we think about a disgust to sewage and to raw human waste, that's pretty much universal. There's no culture that doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a very good reason, too. Sewage and raw waste has so many pathogens, and one of the ways that people die most frequently, and this is still a problem in many parts of the developing world, is because sewage gets into drinking water, it gets into what you eat, and you get incredibly sick. So disgust is a very instinctive reaction, and it's a very good reaction. The problem is when that same circuitry gets short-circuited because we're living in a very different world than the world of our ancestors.
Yeah, what are some of the things that won't harm us, but still people are commonly, let's say, disgusted by?
Well, recycled water, obviously, but also things like eating insects, for instance. We are facing global food shortages. We are facing global warming, where we know that the production of meat in the way that it's currently produced contributes to the gases that are released into the environment. And we have insects, which are a perfectly legitimate form of food. And in fact, in many cultures, you know, many parts of South America, for instance, people traditionally consume insects all the time, you know, ants, grasshoppers, cockroaches even. And when you ask a local Joe from your neighborhood coffee shop, are you going to eat an insect? He'll say, absolutely not. That's really gross. Unless you get someone who's very exceptional. Some people say that they're happy to do it, but that's really the exception to the rule. Then you say, well, what about if I grind up the insect so that it's part of flour and just a very tiny proportion of flour? And this is actually a study that was done by Paul Rosen at the University of Pennsylvania, who studies disgust. Still, they say, no, thank you. I think I'd rather pass. So there's another area. Things like GMOs, we think that that's disgusting because it's not natural, because something's been done to it. So we see it in public policy all the time, but it's not just there. You see it in kind of moral issues, like things that have been touched by people that you personally find repugnant. You don't want to touch them. Yeah. Like if I ask you, do you want to wear Hitler's sweater? What are you going to tell me?
Well, no way. No way in the world would I wear a Hitler sweater.
What if I say, well, what if I unravel it and I'm going to make a totally different sweater for you, and I'm going to make sure that that yarn is really well disinfected.
I can't believe, like, what this is doing to the back of my shoulders right now. There really is this sense of, like, I would not want that to touch my skin.
Exactly. And that is the exact reaction that people get when they see all of these things. It's a concept that's known as contagion. And the psychology behind that is very simple. And that's once in contact, always in contact. So Hitler's sweater was once associated with Hitler. He wore it. It was a part of Hitler. And no matter what you do, once in contact, always in contact.
Well, one of the interesting things about that is the opposite reaction, that there can be a kind of notion of purity that can, for lack of a better word, contaminate the bad thing. Like one of the other things that Rosen tested is if people wouldn't wear Hitler's sweater, what if Mother Teresa wore the same sweater?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Because this is happening on such an abstract moral level, you know, it's this moral revulsion, the only thing that really can counteract it is an incredibly strong force in the opposing direction. And it has to be as strong as Mother Teresa. It can't just be, you know, the local priest, for instance. It has to be someone who you really think is the epitome of good, just like Hitler was the epitome of bad.
So when do we first begin to discuss this? Because I notice, like, you know, kids certainly say, oh, ick, that's gross. You know, they don't want to touch something or eat something.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it turns out that we do develop this pretty early on, around 3 years of age. And first, you have babies and very small children who have absolutely no notion of disgust. So one of the things, and, you know, I started laughing out loud when Paul Rosen and I were talking, and he mentioned this because it had never even occurred to me. He said, you know, children don't just wear diapers to keep themselves clean. It's also to prevent them from eating what's in the diaper.
Oh, my goodness.
Because apparently if they're just allowed to, they will, because it's interesting. At that age, there's really no notion of disgust. But then when they're 3, maybe 4 years old, something seems to shift, and suddenly they'll say, ooh, that's gross. I don't want to touch that. And some of those things are very universal. So, for instance, around that age, basically no children will eat what's in their diaper again. But some of the things are very culturally determined. So a kid growing up, say, in New Hampshire might say an insect is gross to eat, but mm-hmm. someone growing up in Mexico might not.
Well, I'm also wondering about, like, if we as humans outgrow that disinhibition to eating, you know, weird things, like a kid could conceivably eat an insect. Mm-hmm. As the developing world grows and, you know, more people want meat, more people want cars, that kind of thing, does their image of disgust change as they get further and further away from that baseline survival?
Well, unfortunately, it seems to become stronger. So the older we are, the more hardwired our instinctual reactions seem to be. The kids can still be pretty flexible. You could probably convince a 5-year-old that it's okay to eat an insect much more quickly than you could convince a 50-year-old. But there's one thing that goes in the opposite direction, which is necessity. Mm-hmm. So if you put me in an area that's suffering from severe drought and there's literally no water, you know, I cannot get it from any source, and then I bring in recycled water and I'll say, here's recycled water, you can drink it or you can die, then I'm going to overcome my disgust reaction pretty darn quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the same way, I have a colleague who, you know, the thought of raisins just provokes her gag reflex. But if she were really hungry, I'm guessing she would eat raisins.
Exactly. And, you know, if we were freezing somewhere, we would put on Hitler's sweater pretty quickly.
Right. Well, so the problem is psychological, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But can we break that cycle of disgust, especially when you're talking about the future of toilet tap water,
mm-hmm.
which probably shouldn't use the term toilet tap water if you're trying to market it.
That's exactly right. I haven't actually seen any good way of putting it, because as soon as you say toilet to tap, as soon as the notion of toilet is anywhere in there, I think red lights go off no matter what I tell you afterwards. But yes, there are certain things, short of making Mother Teresa drink the water, that do seem to help. One of those is the notion of distance. So we can get over these feelings of immediate disgust if we think that we're further removed from the source. So say, you know, you have water that's treated at this plant, and then it travels thousands of miles for many months, and only then do you drink it. Somehow that makes it more palatable than what Bill Gates is showing, which is, hey, look, 5 minutes ago, this was sewage, and now I am drinking this. Isn't it wonderful? Well, sure, it's pretty incredible technologically, but psychologically, that closeness only makes the disgust reaction stronger. So we can try to couch all of this in ideas of distance, of time, of, you know, oh, this is actually very, very far removed from the thing that you found disgusting. And the other thing is, you know, marketing, plain and simple. Who do you associate with this water, and how do you see it? So if, you know, you have someone very famous who says, you know, hey, my name is Angelina Jolie, and here's me drinking recycled water because it's wonderful and it's safe, and I'm now going to be giving my entire family this water. Well, people do tend to emulate celebrities and people they look up to, so those types of things might actually help.
Maria Konnikova, author, journalist, and she writes a weekly science and psychology column for The New Yorker. Maria, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you can read Maria's piece for yourself, Problems Too Disgusting to Solve. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. We also have a link to the video of Bill Gates drinking the omni-processed water. All right, here's something just about everyone will agree is disgusting, the maggot. And yet, no matter how repulsive, maggots play an important role in the ecosystem. Here's producer Paula Kahumbu on why we should think of maggots as our friends.
No, that's not the sound of a juicy piece of steak sizzling on the barbecue. That's the sound of millions and millions of maggots chewing their way through a juicy piece of steak out here in the Nairobi National Park. Hi, I'm Paula Kahumbu. And I'm here in the Nairobi National Park with Dino Martins, and we're looking at a cow that's died just in the river right on the edge of the national park. He's trying to convince me that I really should care much more for the tiny little critters, even if they really stink.
Well, it's not the maggots that stink, but it's actually the putrefying tissues of the cow. And the more the maggots feed, actually, there'll be less and less stink, because what the maggots will do is take the flesh, feed on it, and turn it into fat maggots that turn into flies that turn into food for flycatchers and drongos. And basically it means this cow will turn into flycatchers, into drongos, into dragonflies, into all these other things in the ecosystem that we love, into fish, into crabs, into even plants.
Ugh, so we're going to end up eating this cow, whether we like it or not, even though it's
yes,
dead.
Yes, the cow is dead, but it's becoming part of the earth again.
They're not ambling, they're kind of inching along in peculiar lines, actually. Why are they doing that?
So what they're doing is maggots tend to facilitate each other's feeding. And what you can see here is there's some concentrations of them, and they are several different species. So they all look like they're just one sort of big squishy mass. But if you look closely, you'll notice there's some which have sort of spikier bodies. And those are the larvae primarily of the very large blowflies that are the bright iridescent green and purple that we see flying around and landing on the carcass. And then there's some smaller ones that are longer and smoother. Those are the larvae of these other flies, which we would call house flies or domestic flies.
So how long does it take? I can see some tiny little ones in there. How long does it take from the time that the fly lays his egg to the maggot eating this cow and then turning back into a fly?
Now, because carcasses generally tend not to be around for very long, flies are very efficient at converting it, and it generally takes 5 to 7 days for a maggot to complete its life cycle from the time the egg is laid. It'll form a pupa, and actually you can see some pupal masses down here, and often they'll go off around the edges of the carcass or into the soil or in the hair. If we were to open some of these dead bits of the hair, we would probably find pupae.
Okay, you said you think they're beautiful. Just tell me the truth, Dino. You don't really think that maggots are beautiful?
I really think maggots are beautiful.
Oh, because, my God, you're disgusting.
Because of what they're doing. Just think how the horror we're surrounded by here, all these dead cows, and just think, if it wasn't for these maggots cleaning it up, would you like to clean it up, Paula?
I wouldn't. Actually, you know what? I'd like to just get out of here right now. It stinks so badly, I'm going to throw up in a minute.
Thank you, maggots.
If you're anything like me, the very sound of those writhing maggots made you cringe. Well, coming up, we're going to hear about a medical condition. It's called misophonia, which literally means a hatred of sound. If you ever wanted to scream at someone for slurping their soup, you may want to hear this. So stay tuned. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. One of my colleagues cannot bear to hear other people bite into apples without cringing. Another can't stand the sound of people blowing their nose. For me, people chewing with their mouths open triggers paroxysms of disgust. There are people who have acute, angry, even violent reactions to sounds. It is a syndrome called misophonia. And Dr. Baron Lerner, a primary care physician, author, and professor at NYU, wrote about his experience suffering with misophonia for the New York Times Well blog. And plenty of people felt his pain. Dr. Baron Lerner, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you have misophonia. What is it exactly?
Well, the term means hatred of sounds, but it refers to particular sounds that certain groups of people get, an angry reaction or a frustrated reaction when they hear particular noises. And there's certain noises that seem to be most common among this group of people.
What are some of the common irritants?
Big one is very much people who chew with their mouths open. People who eat particular noisy foods like apples or potato chips, people who sort of snort their mucus back into their nose instead of blowing their nose, pen clicking. So it's a whole variety of different symptoms that seem to generate this frustration and anger in a group of people.
So I mentioned that some people are irritated by this, but how does it actually show up for you?
Well, for me, it's very, like a lot of the ones I mentioned are high on my list. So I will be going about my business, and I want to emphasize that I don't go looking for these noises, but I will hear something and it'll grab me. So I'll feel an acute sense of irritation because I'm hearing this noise. And the syndrome is made worse, by the way, because people who suffer from misophonia often get angry and frustrated at the people who are making the noise and feel that they're rude. And that seems to generate even more emotions among the sufferers.
Well, you're a primary care physician. Wouldn't that get in the way of your job? Somebody, you know, especially mucusy sounds.
Well, yes and no. I mean, fortunately, I guess I'm not plagued by this all the time. It's usually episodic. I could imagine a patient being in my office who kept sort of sniffing their mucus back into their nose every 30 seconds while I was trying to concentrate, and I might say to that person, would you mind blowing your nose? Because it's distracting to me. You know, that's probably one of the rare situations where I could get away with doing that because I actually have the authority to do that there. It's harder if you're on the subway or on the train that I would ask a stranger to do that. The question for me is, how am I going to relieve myself in that situation from the symptoms?
What do you do? I mean, you can't run screaming from the room, right?
Don't do the running and screaming part, but I walk away if I can. So, for example, if I'm on a train and there's someone eating loudly or who needs to blow their nose, I will move to a different part of the train car. When we go to movies, my wife could tell you stories and stories about this. When we go to movies, I'm always scouring the movie theater to see if anyone has a big vat of popcorn, and I try not to sit in front of them. So I do try to avoid it. And then if it happens, I try to delicately move my body to a place where the sound no longer exists.
There is a video accompanying your post on Well, and it is of a man chewing popcorn. Oh, my God, it's excruciating. But I wondered, it's because I had to watch it. Is it just the noise, or is it, you're suggesting context. You're in a movie theater, you're trapped. You're in a subway car, someone's clipping their nails. You're trapped on some level.
I think the context is very important. So I watched that video, which I did not supply, and it immediately triggered the annoyance for me. But my guess is there's most people watching the video would not be annoyed because this syndrome affects a small percent of the population. Nobody knows how much. And that's fascinating to me because one of the frustrations is I hear the noise. I hear that popcorn noise or the sniffling noises. Not only am I sort of angry at the person who's making the noise, but I'm incredibly frustrated that everyone sitting around me isn't as equally irritated as I am. So it really, it plays with your mind a little bit. And it's for some people, it's really hard to manage all these emotions.
Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't be laughing about this, but your description of it is kind of funny. This was only recently named misophonia. Is it a disorder, disease? What do we know about its causes?
Well, not a lot yet. Doctors began to call it misophonia in about 2002. So it's about a decade or so old. You know, I think it's very, very helpful. There's certainly skeptics who I mentioned in my article who would roll their eyes and say, you know, you just find these people irritating. You don't have a disease. You're just impatient or you're just irritable. And I understand that sort of response, but I sort of know both, I think, from my own symptoms and from reading about this condition in other people that I think really it's very helpful to have it named. The best information that's out there, it seems to be related to the limbic system of the brain, which is where you process emotions. And it seems to be some kind of a hypersensitivity between the limbic part of the brain and the auditory system, what you hear.
With so little known about misophonia, what might be a cure? Is it a psychiatric disorder? Is it something else?
Certainly, some people who have it have other psychiatric conditions, like OCD in particular, some people with depression. So trying to treat the associated psychiatric condition might make sense, and it might help this. But it might be more purely neurological, and if that's the case. So the unifying approach, I think, at this point are a couple of things. One is some type of behavioral therapy where you just learn to avoid or deal with these noises, or two, masking the noises. So lots of people with this syndrome use things like white noise machines and earplugs to try to mask away the sounds.
Dr. Baron Lerner, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Baron Lerner, he's professor of medicine and population health at NYU, and he's also author of The Good Doctor. He wrote the blog post, Stop Making That Noise. It's all about misophonia, and it appeared in the New York Times Well blog. Times readers responded in droves, posting the sounds that drive them nuts. Among them, nail clipping, gum smacking, and nose sniffling. And we're about to play for you the sound that an overwhelming 1 in 4 respondents cannot abide: soup slurping. So if you've been diagnosed with misophonia or think that you have a mild case, you might want to turn down your radio for just the next few seconds. Yuck. You want to know what gets under the skin of Ty Burr? Television. And it's not the programming. He likes that. It's all the paid subscriptions and extra gadgets and passwords and remotes required for today's supposed when-you-want-it, on-demand viewing habits. Ty Burr is a film critic and columnist for the Boston Globe, and he joined us for a relatable rant on why it's time to simplify television.
You know, the funny thing is I'm actually good at this stuff compared to other people in my life who will remain nameless, as far as, you know, figuring out which of the 5 remotes I need to pick up to turn something on and where to find a particular show. But I was actually pushed over the edge recently when my wife and I have been following this show called Jane the Virgin. That's this adorable little comedy that's sort of a spoof of Spanish language telenovelas. And we were trying to find the original episodes from earlier in the season. We couldn't find them on demand. We couldn't find them anywhere. I finally had to go to my Roku box, one of those little boxes that attaches to your TV set, and call up a service I'd never heard of called Vudu and pay money, you know, $1.99 to get the episodes without ads, or I could have waited, you know, 2 months for them to come back onto on demand with ads. I mean, following a TV show used to be very easy. You turned on the TV at the time that they said it was going to be, and you would watch it, and that was it. And I appreciate the fact that we can see them, we can time shift, you know, we can see them at other times. But, you know, the culture goes through periods of fragmentation and consolidation. And right now we're so knee-deep in a period of fragmentation that myself and a lot of people I know have trouble watching TV, finding the shows we want to watch.
In fact, finding the shows you want to watch, you call it a snipe hunt or a postmodern whack-a-mole. Just loved the image of trying
to find
them.
Well, they keep popping up in different places. I mean, if it's in one place and it stays there, I don't mind necessarily paying for it if I'm not going to get ads. I understand that transaction, but stay in one place. What I don't have, you know, and the other thing is that everybody has a different setup and different configuration at home, so you can't go to your neighbor or call up your brother-in-law and say, "What do I do?" Because they have a totally different setup.
I've just been through this last week. I went to a friend's house. She said I had already seen Birdman, and I wanted to rewatch it. She was watching it on demand, and there were like 3 of us sitting there, and she went to get something in the kitchen. She said, "Okay, you can just start it." And we just looked at this pile of remotes and boxes and had no idea what to do.
Well, here's what you have to do. You know, my in-laws came to stay, and I had to literally type up a 5-page document going step by step how to turn on the TV. How to, you know, if you want to watch this, here's the box you have to turn on. Here's the remote. I put a number on each remote. I mean, it's kind of insane, and it makes you realize that it's perhaps getting out of control. And honestly, if somebody like me, who's kind of an early adopter and is fairly adept at navigating these things, if I'm having trouble, God, what's going on with people who have more trouble with these things?
Well, and you're a media person, too. I mean, how many subscriptions do you think you have in this hydra of an entertainment system?
Let me see. I've got Netflix. I've got Hulu Plus. I've got Fandor. I've got, you know, I'm paying bit by bit on Vudu whenever I want to watch Jane the Virgin. And that's not counting the cable subscription. You know, it's death by 1,000 bites. you know, it's, remember free TV?
Yes, I actually do. And that's, I was going to ask you that, Ty. I mean, is this just because we're old? I mean, 20-year-olds don't have problems with this. They just download things illegally, right?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what they do. And actually, in the column that I wrote about it, I asked one of the interns at the Globe, you know, well, how do you watch your TV shows? Oh, I download them illegally through this site. I go to that site, and it basically sends you to a link that is somewhere in Eastern Europe that I do not want to go, because God knows what's going to come back down the pipe toward me, given all the horror stories we've heard about identity theft.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the younger audiences are adept at getting what they want, but they also, you know, probably don't have, you know, credit reports that are going to come back and bite them on the tush. So it is, you know, for them, it's easy. They also don't have a problem with watching it on their computers or watching it, God forbid, on their phone. For us old-fashioned fogies who like to actually watch it on a TV set, it's kind of problematic. And I think the industry, and I'm not sure what part of the industry, really needs to sit up and kind of address it, whether it's the cable companies, whether it's the networks, whether it's the production companies, whether it's the makers of the boxes or the makers of the TVs, or maybe it's a third party that comes in and says, here's a site, here's something that will tell you, you plug in what you want to find, and we'll find it for you.
And that was Boston Globe columnist Ty Burr. You'll find a link to read his article, Time to Put the TV Back in the Box. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to know what bugs you the most. The thought of maggots writhing? The sound of soup slurping? Or struggling to work your own entertainment system? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And if you missed any of today's show, you can go back and catch the whole thing by subscribing to our podcast in iTunes. Just search for Word of Mouth NHPR. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend or rate it. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.